All right, well, with that, I'll move on and go ahead and introduce our speaker, which is Ken Feldman. And he's here tonight with us from Penn State. He's in the chemistry department out there. And he's going to be talking today about Waste Not, Want Not, the story of dissolved organic carbon in the reef aquarium. So, Ken, thank you.
My name's Ken.
Okay, so tonight I'm going to... Tonight I'm going to be telling you about dissolved organic carbon in your reef aquarium. And really the story of dissolved organic carbon is the story of the balance between DOC input and DOC removal. And DOC input originates from the fish we have in our aquarium. For instance, we feed the fish uneaten fish food or fish poop contributes to the carbon load. And in addition, the corals that we have in our aquarium secrete an organic rich mucus almost continually into the water column, and that also contributes significantly to the level of dissolved organic carbon in our aquarium. This isn't really a bad thing, because dissolved organic carbon is called the soil of the sea for a reason. It's the foundational element of the food web on authentic reefs, and presumably in our tanks as well. How much more can you? Okay. In our tanks as well. But you know, we're all worried that this sort of rising tide of organic pollution in our tanks may cause unwanted compromise health of our livestock, cause algae blooms, other unwanted properties. And so we invest pretty heavily, probably all of us do, in some kind of mechanical filtration, protein skimmers, granular activated carbon, as a means to kind of keep the organic level in check, or at least so the equipment manufacturers have led us to believe. And also we kind of suspect that bacteria probably play some role in this whole water remediation process, but we can't really see them. We don't really know how many are there. We're not really sure just how much they contribute. And so basically we skim some more in an effort to maintain this balance between input and DOC removal. So in the talk today, what I'll be telling you about is the dissolved organic and total organic carbon levels on authentic reefs, okay? Also in some representative reef tanks, so you can see just how good we're doing as hobbyists. I'll tell you about the effectiveness of both protein skimming and granular activated carbon in removing dissolved organics from reef aquarium water. And lastly, at the end of my talk, I'll touch on some of the roles that bacteria may play in this whole water remediation business. So I want to get started, really. And by the way, please feel free to interrupt with questions. I assume we're all informal here. You're used to doing this. So shoot away. I want to get started with sort of in the beginning, telling you where dissolved organic carbon comes from on a reef. Right, so on a reef, or in fact in our reef tanks, there's a couple of corals from my reef tank, the dissolved organic carbon enters as inorganic carbon, carbon dioxide, and then there's some nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus nutrients, and the photosynthetic organisms like the zooxanthellae within the corals photosynthesize and they excrete dissolved organic carbon, primarily carbohydrates, some amino acids, right back into the water column, okay? And this secretion is perfect food for microbes in the tank, bacteria, plankton, phytoplankton, etc. These guys serve as a terrific food source for various higher organisms in the food chain, zooplankton, copepod, etc. And all these guys are food for the corals, depending upon the size of the coral's mouth. And so you see there's a recycling aspect to this food chain where carbon comes in here as carbon dioxide, gets converted to organic carbon by photosynthesizing organisms, then cycles back and feeds them. Well, how efficient is this recycling? And this is a question of actually some significance to reef ecology. And the first person to take a crack at this was Sorokin, and he used sort of a chemical ecology approach and came to the conclusion that maybe 80% or so of this carbon actually is cycled within a reef, which is really an impressive thing considering the water surrounding the reef is really nutrient deficient, and this is how the nutrients then stay on the reef. Atkinson came by maybe about 10 years later and said, no, that's wrong. And he used sort of a systems engineering approach and determined, probably more accurately actually, that only maybe 20, 30, 40% remained on the reef. And the rest of this organic pollution was swept out to sea. So reefs, of course, have this infinite ocean to clear away pollution. We as aquarists don't have that much. So what happens in our aquaria? Okay? Well, here's an experiment done about a dozen years ago by Faria Cages. And what she did was she just took some of the corals that we keep, Martipara, Fabia, et cetera, put them in a tank, some sand, some water, metal halide lighting, shone a light on it, and she was measuring dissolved organic carbon levels as a function of lights on after the halos came up. And you can see that in the beginning, nothing much is happening. The level here is about 2 parts per million. That's this 2 here. And it just kind of goes across as time goes on, and all of a sudden, it zooms up. So what's happened here is these corals have photosynthesized, emitted some dissolved organic carbon, and she's picking that up. But the important point of this graph is what happens next. So you see over the next couple of hours, with no mechanical filtration, no skimmers, no GAC, no nothing, the levels come right back down to pretty much baseline. What's going on? The DOC consumers, the DOC predators, the bacteria and other microbes are scavenging this up. So in this sort of natural ecosystem without any added food, okay, there's a sort of a balance or equilibrium, if that's the right word, to describe what happens to the carbon levels. But what about in a situation where there is an addition? What happens when this situation goes haywire? Things can get bad. And that question was posed by a guy named Forrest Rover, who's a sort of a leading coral researcher. And what he wondered was, how does human pollution affect corals, okay, in natural reefs? Is there some correlation? And what he did was he took frags of this Caribbean coral, Montastra angularis, put them in little cups of water, and challenged them with various carbohydrates as models for sort of human pollution or dissolved organic carbon. And what he was measuring was coral death. Was he able to kill corals by dosing them with sugar? Okay? And the data that we collected is shown here. What you're looking at in these colored bars is percent mortality after 30 days. And so the further the bar stretches over to the right, the more lethal to that coral, to this particular coral. So you can see in the control where he added no carbohydrates, 10% of the corals died. We all have about 10% coral death in our tanks, more or less, and maybe some more, right? It just sort of happens, and that's what he's seeing. Now, with 10 parts per million lactose, he got 65% coral death. 2 parts per million lactose, about the same as glucose, 20%. And so it's appropriate to conclude from these data that these particular carbohydrates are lethal to this particular coral at these levels, but it's not appropriate to conclude that all carbon sources are lethal to all corals in any way. Okay?
So, but he was looking at lactose and glucose as a human.
He was looking at that as a controllable source of carbon because he knew that bacteria fed off these particular things.
But where would that specifically lactose and glucose come from as far as where would that be introduced into the ocean as human?
They wouldn't be human pollution, but he didn't know what exactly the carbon source was in human pollution, so he said, let's use a model system that is controllable, okay, and did that. Anyhow, so like you're looking for now, he was looking for a connection between addition of carbon source and death of corals, and the connection that he drew was a bacteria. So corals are totally covered with bacteria. The surface is an entire sheet of bacteria. It's called a coral holobiont, and it's absolutely critical for the life cycle of the coral. So a coral is a symbiotic organism, much like you are, that's composed a lot of bacteria, much like you are, okay? And so he speculated that when you dose bacteria with a carbon source that serves as a fuel, the bacteria grow like crazy on the surface, and that increase in bacteria causes, for some reason unknown, the death of the coral. He speculated it could be oxygen deprivation at the surface through the activity of metabolic activity of the bacteria, pathogenic bacteria grow up, etc. And so that's his rationale for why this nice-looking little pora ends up kind of necrosing, like you see there. Okay. So that raises an overall question. If corals sort of give out maybe a little bit of DOC that gets eaten by the bacteria, but then if you dose it with a lot, like we do in our reef tank with food sources and everything, what exactly is the carbon level on a reef? What's natural? What's the carbon level in your reef tank? How close are you getting to the natural level? So many, many people have looked at carbon levels in various natural environments. Just to give you a baseline reading, in the deep ocean where there's no photosynthesis, thousands of feet deep, there's about a half of a part per million of carbon. That's the baseline. Okay? Just incidentally, the amount of carbon that we're talking about in the ocean is about equal to the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere of CO2. Okay? There's a lot of carbon in the ocean. Okay? It's a great sink of carbon. Now, what happens when we go from the deep ocean to healthy, normal, thriving reefs where these corals that we love and keep do well? No matter where you go in the world, Pacific, Caribbean, Red Sea, the levels are surprising, maybe not surprising, in a fairly narrow range, around 0.7 up to about 1.4 parts per million. Greece all over the world look like that. That's where corals have evolved to be happy at, okay? And so that's presumably where we want to keep our reef tanks. What happens when it goes bad? If you look in Tokyo Bay or Florida Bay, the carbon levels are up to the 10 part per million range. You don't find any stony corals in these locations. Although, of course, soft corals will grow in these locations. So there is some sort of a threshold, which I don't really have a good fix on, where stony corals just don't make it. It's certainly not as high as 10, but they can do okay with 2. Okay? Now, all these data were taken with a piece of equipment called the Shimadzu TOC analyzer. This is kind of the gold standard in TOC analysis, and the reason why I said it is we'll come back to that in just a little bit. So what does this have to do with what we care about, or reefs? We're talking about ocean life. So the questions we ask are, what exactly are the carbon levels in reef tanks? And secondly, how effective are all the water remediation methodology we employ, skimming, GAC, granular activated carbon, at scrubbing aquarium water? So the problem we face is, sure enough, we have fish, we have corals, you feed the fish poop, pollution, what are we going to do about it? Okay? To start off that story, let me give you a remote tank tour of State College, Pennsylvania, a reefing mecca, okay? My home tank. Let me just tell you what the levels are in some tanks. So this is my tank. It's 168 gallons of water. It has a skimmer plus GAC. I change my water. And a bunch of fish, bunch of corals, the usual suspects. I feed my tank. Is it possible to get brighter on this projector?
You can turn the lights down.
Yeah, I'm just kind of thinking.
Do you know the lights?
Yeah, I think some of my slides later are going to be a little bit darker, like this one. It'll be darker. And what I'm showing you here is what I feed my tank. Okay, so every day I feed it some flake food, some frozen mice or shrimp, and some reef nutrition products, rotifeast, phytofeast, artipods. And if you dry all this stuff down to a solid, it's about a little bit more than four grams a day. Put that into my tank every day. And when we started this experimental procedure, this particular tank was about 1 year old, and that was in the summer of 2008, and I was pretty happy to see that when we measured the TOC level, it was about one part per million, plus or minus a little bit, depending upon the day I measured. Right where healthy reefs are. Okay, first time anybody ever measured a reef tank, and it turned out to be where we hoped it would be. Nothing funny going on here. But then imagine my surprise when we went back to this problem a year later in 2009, and I saw that my TOC level had dropped down half, to about half of a part per million, okay? No difference in my husbandry. What in the heck happened to my tank that caused this change? And what happened to my tank was my tank matured. And what I really mean by that is, I don't know if you can tell in this picture, but all the non-irradiated cryptic surfaces underneath all my rocks, they were all populated by sponges, and these are these tube worms and filter feeders. Filter feeders covered every area. Filter feeders are absolutely terrific at scrubbing microbes from your aquarium water. If you wonder how good they are, there's a paper by Rives and Atkinson I would refer you to. And of course, these microbes eat dissolved organic carbon. So I have a natural biological filtration system that's really doing a good job in my tank. I am skimming and I do use GAC. We'll come back and just see how important those are. Okay. So now let's take a look at a couple of other tanks. This is Sanjay's tank. Sanjay will be here in October. 550-gallon reef tank, plus skimmer, plus GAC, plus water change. And his TOC levels are also a little bit more than one part per million, just where healthy reefs are. All of everything makes sense so far. Okay. This is a 600-gallon tank at the Penn State Student Union that Sanjay maintains, plus skimmer, plus GAC, plus water change, one part per million TOC. So far I'm showing you some kind of biggish tanks, and they all seem to mimic what natural healthy reefs have, and they all look like natural healthy reef tanks. So things seem to be working out for us so far. Okay. But now let me throw a curveball at you. This is another tank under Sanjay's care. This is a tank in which he has a much more relaxed approach toward aquarium husbandry. And what you see here is a 29-gallon tank. It has a bunch of soft corals, some fish, no sand bed, no skimmer, no GAC, he never changes the water. Okay, but rarely, because he's heard this talk and I want to be polite, but the truth is he doesn't care for it. And look at the TOC level, 5 to 6 parts per million. Well, that makes sense, right? We're not purifying this tank in any way, shape, or form. The water quality maybe isn't so good. Nevertheless, the soft corals are okay, but Sanjay cannot grow stony corals in here. Maybe that's not a surprise. Let's take another look at another one of Sanjay's tanks. This is a a 55-gallon under his care. No skimmer, no water change. Look at that TOC level, 0.6 to 0.7. One-tenth as big, or one-tenth as small, I should say, as this level. What in the heck is going on here? Well, the difference is gas. He uses granular activated carbon on this tank, not in this tank. Could GAC really be that effective at scrubbing organic material from occurring water? We're going to come back to that later on in the talk. Don't be surprised if I tell you it is. Okay. I want to draw your attention to one other aspect of the composition of this tank. There's no protein skimmer on this tank. Okay? No skimmer, no problem keeping the TOC levels way down. Okay? It does begin to raise the question, what exactly is that fancy skimmer doing that we all invest in and tweak on our tanks? Well, I'm going to spend some time talking about that next. Here's just a reminder of the food that I put in my tank. And the experiment we're doing is this. I take my tank, I feed my tank. I measure my TOC levels over a period of time. Because all the tanks I just showed you, they were sort of one-shot measurements. So they didn't really tell you if the TOC levels fluctuate as a consequence of feeding or maybe lights on, lights off, or something like that. So, here's the experiment. My tank before I feed it has a TOC level of around 0.4 parts per million. That's this little pinkish square, okay? And this is a day, 24 hours. This is a TOC level in my tank. And so then I add food to my tank. And I measured about an hour after I add food, and the TOC level's up here about 1.4. Makes sense, I add food, TOC level somehow goes up. But you see now, time marches on, and after, say, 2 hours, it's down to about 0.8. After 4 hours, it's down to about 0.5, 0.6. And there it remains for 24 hours. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this experiment, as you can see, is my skimmer and my granular activated carbon are off. No mechanical filtration. Just feeding my tank and let the natural biological filter take over. And you can see that even though this isn't just Carl-generated TOC, it's from addition of food, the natural biological mechanism seems to keep it pretty well in check. Now, one thing we humans like to do is organize things. And one way to organize a data set is to draw a line through it, so I did. Okay? And the advantage of drawing a line is it allows me to compare different data sets without having the interference of all these data points, which just kind of mess up lines. So I did this experiment 3 times in 3 different days, and the point of this graph is to show you that they're all just about the same. I'm now reporting not the absolute value of the TOC, but just the percent remaining, which allows me to kind of start them all at 100. The percent remaining is after it goes to the highest level. But you can see they all drop back down to maybe 40, 50% level. My skimmer is off, my GAC is off. Now what do you think would happen?
I'm looking for table 14.
I know, it just seems
weird. Steve. What do you think would happen if I did that exact same experiment but I had my skimmer on? Well, we all believe that skimmers are very effective at stripping organic from the tank water, so we might expect that the depletion curve would be even steeper. The skimmer plus the bacterial filtration would drop it down even faster, maybe drop it down lower. The skimmer should surely do something, right? So let's reproduce this experiment, but now my skimmer's on, my GAC's not on. That's the 3 green lines. And what you can see is, did 3 different experiments, 3 different days, the green lines are pretty much coincident on the pink lines. So whether my skimmer is on or my skimmer is off, my total organic carbon level in my tank doesn't seem to care. It goes up after you feed it, that makes sense, and then drops back down to some comfortable steady state level. Equilibrium is not quite the right word. Steady state level, okay, somewhere around, let's say, you know, the 30 to 50% where it was. There's some variation here, obviously. But the skimmer doesn't seem to be doing a whole heck of a lot. Uh-oh. I know all of you spent a lot of money on skimmers, just like I did, by the way, okay, before I did any of this research. And now you might be saying, wait a second, what's going on here? Okay, well, it's obviously more of the story than this. This data set was taken over the course of a day, 24 hours. But 24 hours, maybe that's not enough time to measure maybe accumulation of TOC. That might happen gradually. Somebody had a question?
So if you feed more than 1 time a day, then it's going to go up and down, up and down.
Yes, it does. In this particular experiment, I just fed it once a day, just for the purpose of doing the experiment. So yeah, it will fluctuate. You can see that in my particular tank, no reason to think it's true in your tank, it takes about 6 to 8 hours for it to come back down. So So you can think about that kind of as a periodicity, but that's just my thing. So let's see what happens over the course of a month, okay? This is a different experiment. It's a little bit trickier, because we're not using my tank. I'm using Sanjay's 500-gallon tank. And this is actually a skimmer comparison experiment. We did two different months, two different skimmers. We wondered if the skimmer would matter. So one skimmer is this do-it-yourself homemade skimmer by Sanjay. It's a little downdraft. And then he decided it was time to upgrade. So this is basically a homemade Bubble King skimmer. It has a Red Dragon pump with a bubble plate and the whole nine yards. It's about, it's 10 times as expensive as that skimmer, okay, in terms of what Sanjay paid. And so the experiment is, he feeds his tank, and 12 hours after feeding, we pull a water sample, measure the total organic carbon over the time period of the month. No water changes for the month. Skimmer's running, so this is not a skimmerless experiment. GAC's running. We just want to see if there's any accumulation. Okay? And here's the data set. So total organic carbon levels on the y-axis, time and day stretching out for 30 days. And let's look at the downdraft skimmer first. This is a turquoise data set. We start around 0.6, 0.5, 0.6 parts per million right here. And you can see that as time goes on for a week, nothing much changes. But then the second week, it begins to creep up a little. Third week, up, up, up. Fourth week. And by the time we're done, the TOC level's gone up to maybe about 0.8, 0.9, starting at about 0.5, 0.6. Okay? So there has been an accumulation. Let's see what happens when we use the fancier needle wheel skimmer. That's the pink triangles. Again, we start at the same place, around 0.6. And now you see it creeps up, the TOC levels in the second month experiment creeps up even higher up to, I don't know, around 1.1, 1.2. So what does this experiment tell us? It tells us a couple of important things. It tells us that there is total organic... Well, let's... So Bruce says don't use the skimmer. Let's find out how prescient he actually is, okay? So one thing it tells us is that there's different kinds of total organic carbon that we can just make artificial or arbitrary categories. There's obviously total organic carbon that's removed by skimming, but there's some total organic carbon that's not removed by skimming, it's not removed by GAC, and it's not removed by biological filtration. So the three legs of our water remediation stool do not touch that particular dissolved organic carbon. Total organic carbon creeps up. Some of it's eaten by microbes, some of it's not eaten by microbes, presumably, because, as I said, it creeps up. Some, according to Forrest Roher, is harmful to livestock. I can't really speak to that in any general sense. And some, presumably, is not. Okay. There's obviously this overlap between these different categories, and I wish I could tell you a little bit more about how the overlap goes. For some circumstantial reasons, I think there's pretty good overlap between removed by skimmer and eaten by microbes. Okay. But that's just a circumstantial. And the other thing that this experiment tells us is that it is a very old-fashioned, for all you people who are getting back in the hobby, it's a very old-fashioned, very low-tech way to help your water remediation situation do water changes. I know it's old-fashioned, but it does work. And so this graph is really an advertisement for water changes. So I didn't allow Sanjay to do water changes over a month. And if you simply average these data sets for convenience, you find the TOC level jumps from about 0.53 to about 0.95. It's a 79% increase, no water change. Any question?
Yeah. Is there any correlation with like nitrates and phosphates?
We didn't measure. We will look at correlations later in my talk, or some, not correlations, but some information later in my talk. But in this particular experiment, we didn't measure that. Okay. Now, if I were to let Sanjay do a weekly 10% water change, that's pretty reasonable, okay? Just by simple dilution math, the TOC only would have crept up 25%. That's just dilution math, okay? So the point is that there's really a fourth leg of the water remediation, a stool, along with bacteria, granular activated carbon, and skimming. Please do water changes. It really does matter. Okay?
How often do you change the granulated carbon?
Sanjay did not change it for this month. That, by the way,
was brand new on day zero.
It was brand new at day zero. He never changed it. Although I'm not going to talk. I don't think I talked about it in this talk. We actually published a paper about telling you when your GAC gets saturated, so when you should change it, based on other analysis. A month is a bad idea. But that was not my business. That was Sanjay's.
But actually, it can become beneficial because sometimes the bacteria, because of breeding ground bacteria.
Bacteria will certainly
biological.
Grow. Yeah.
After it absorbs, it actually turns to biological.
And then you'll have a coating of bacteria on your GAC. When you throw the bacteria out, you're throwing bacteria out, and so you're essentially purifying the nutrients out of your tank at all. So, I mean, that's absolutely true. Actually, I'll come back to that. Anyhow, one thing that kind of worried me, interested me, concerned me, what the heck is going on with these two different skimmers? Why was one skimmer doing different than another? Should I have expected that? Is there some literature on skimmers that would have clued me in to what I should have expected? And so to answer that question, I went, like you all do, to the skimmer literature to learn a little bit more about skimmers. And so the skimmer literature really means manufacturer websites. That's really what there is. So here are some quotes from manufacturer websites. Precision Marine claims their skimmers will outperform anything. Their fracturing is triple organics quickly. Not to be outdone, the World Exclusive line, which makes Bubble King, boasts about exceptional waste abstraction, protein extraction is remarkably increased. Well, there's no protein in reef tank water. This is sort of irrelevant, but still there it is. And then, of course, EuroReef, not to be late to the party, brags about unrivaled removal of organics, higher performance, blah, blah, blah. Well, they can't all be right. What the heck are they actually measuring in order to buttress these claims of superiority or even performance? And the answer, as you probably have figured out by now, is absolutely nothing. There's no measurement of skimmer performance. This is empty advertising. So we thought, this goes back a couple of years, maybe we could figure out how to measure skimmer performance quantitatively, compare different skimmers, and come to some conclusion about which one may or may not be better. That's where I'm going with this. But to get there, I need to figure out how to do a skimmer performance measure. So how am I going to do that? Well, I was pretty naive. I haven't been in Aquarius very long, just since 04. So this is maybe 06, 07, I'm taking these things. And I went to Reef Central and started reading the skimmer threads. And so there you learn that these skimmer fanboys brag about the performance of their skimmers ad nauseum. And one of the things that they talk about is the quality of the skimmate as a criteria for the effectiveness of their skimmer. And so, for example, just to illustrate a point, if they saw a skimmate that was this deep, rich, coffee-like color with a nice head of foam, they might conclude that the skimmer was functioning adequately or even maybe more than adequately. But on the other hand, if they were treated to a skimmate that was this weak, tea-like color with just a little bit of foam, they might be concerned the skimmer was underperforming. If they were obsessive enough, they might go out and spend more money and buy a bigger skimmer. But both of those conclusions would be incorrect. Because not only is this a deep, rich, coffee-like skimmate, but it's basically a cup of coffee that I poured into my skimmer cup. And it took a couple of drops of dish soap and put it in and blew into it with a straw to make bubbles. Okay? And if you dry out this cup of coffee, you end up getting 2.7 grams of instant coffee. Okay? So what's this stuff? This stuff here is 10 grams of brown sugar that I put into a cup of water. And so the point of these pictures is to hopefully convince you that the really important thing about what skimmers do is how much stuff do they pull out of your aquarium. Not the color, flavor, smell, or volume of the skimmate.
Taste
of the skimmate. Which I hope many of you have not experienced this, I hope. Okay. In any event, how much stuff does a skimmer pull out? That's an important number, I think, to judge skimmer performance. So one thing we could do in principle was take some real skimmate, this is from my tank, and carefully scrape it out, and for instance, dry it down, and then get some solid junk, and this junk happened to be about 4 grams, a little bit more than 4 grams a day for a period of a week, I think, or something, of solid stuff. And in principle, I could do this experiment by putting different skimmers on my tank over a same period of time, measuring how much stuff comes out, and maybe come to a conclusion. That makes a little sense, except for the fact that this is a really nasty experiment to run. I had to use a razor blade to scrape the skimmate out of here, and I ended up cutting myself, and I basically never wanted to touch skimmate again.
Ken, where did you dry it? Because that had to smell.
I used a vacuum system.
Okay. He's got a lab.
That's right.
It's not like he's doing this in a garage.
I mean, I dried it at like 110 degrees at about 0.1 torr, and it's really dry.
Yeah, okay.
So we need another way to measure skimmer performance. And I've been telling you all along that we can measure total organic carbon levels in reef tank water. What if we just took a chunk of reef tank water, put it in a tub, stuck a skimmer in it, and skimmed that water? If we measure the total organic carbon level over time, we might be able to see it decrease as we yank out the carbon by the skimming action. So that's the experiment that we pursued. And so here are the students who are working on this. This is Kelly Mayer, in that test. This is a Shimadzu analyzer right here. And so this is a typical data set. We pull out 30 gallons.
How many of those tests do you have? No one of those in your garage.
do you have a Kelly or a Matt in your garage? Matt actually is now in Emory Medical School, going to be a doctor. One of the great advantages of being Penn State and doing this research is I'm a chemistry professor. I do a lot of chemistry research in my day job. There's a whole population of kids who just love Aquaria and have all different backgrounds and just want to do Aquaria research. And they're, like I said, Matt's pre-med. Kelly's actually a biology major. Matt's out. Anyhow, so this is a typical data set. This is a Eurereath CS80 skimmer. And so what we're doing is we're measuring the percent TOC remaining in a 30-gallon sample of water, which I pull from my tank under certain conditions, over the course of 2 hours of time. And you can see it starts off at 100% before we turn the skimmer on. After, 20 minutes, it's down to 95%. After 40 minutes, it's down to about 80%. And look at that. It kind of flatlines at 80%. 20% removed, that is, 80% remaining. And as I showed you before, we can draw a line through it because that removes the unsmoothness of the data points. Okay? And we can do not only the Eurereath CS80 skimmer, but we can do a Bubble King mini skimmer for the heck of it. And you see it has a different depletion profile. It doesn't drop down as fast as a Eurereath, but it seems to go a little bit lower, maybe 75%. Is that a statistically significant difference? We can eyeball it, but that isn't really the right way to do it. And in order to get a statistically significant conclusion, we have to do a bunch of mathematical analysis and extract numbers that I'm not going to bore you with. But before we even do that and I present my data, we have to do one more absolutely critical experiment. We have to do a control to demonstrate that the skimmer action itself, the bubbles, are actually responsible for the depletion in the carbon layer. So all we need to do is take a pot of water. So here's a tub, I should say. It's a Rubbermaid tub with the water over it. Stick a skimmer in it. Maybe the plastic of the skimmer is absorbing carbon. Then it needs to turn the bubbles on. I don't know. So we just stuck a skimmer in it and just measured the TOC over the course of 2 hours. And that's the line right here, the black line. And you see it stays at 100%.
Skimmer's doing something good.
So the skimmer is pulling carbon out of the tank, right, when you turn it on.
20% for how much money?
Well, let's come back to that on the next slide, actually.
Yeah, the 116.
You sorry?
Those two skimmers are about the same price.
Let's find out on the next slide how much they cost. Okay, well, actually, yeah, we will in a sec. So here's the seven skimmers that we tested. We did a Eurereath CSA. We're looking at different ways to generate bubbles, actually. So here's a Eurereath CSA. It's a needle wheel, Precision Marine Venturi, Precision Marine Airstone. How many of you ever heard of an Airstone? He custom made it for me.
I was going to say, because
I know. I had to call my ass and he made it. Yeah. It wasn't cheap. An ETSS downdraft skimmer, a Reef Octopus pinwheel with a little recirculating pufferoo back here, the Bubble King Mini with it's a needle wheel. We did a cone skimmer, the Royal Exclusive 170 cone.
Dave is going to be very upset that he didn't see a
delta. They were too big. I couldn't get a small one, and we were budget limited.
Yeah.
I had to pay retail for this. And so there are two things that we measured in our study. We measured the rate of organic removal, and we measured the amount of organic removal. And
did you compare that to the air flow rate on all the skimmers?
Not all. Because that's... Just one. Okay. We connected it. And decided not even to talk about the rate of removal. The very simple reason that after thinking about this a while, I realized that all the rate of removal means is how quickly you have to empty your skimmer cup. And what's the big deal if you have to empty your skimmer cup after 6 days or 7 days? You're going to empty it when it's convenient for you anyhow. So I didn't see that rate of removal matter, but how much the skimmer removed, that mattered more to me. And so here's our data. And what you're looking at is the percentage of TOC removed for each of these skimmers under the same conditions, and as far as these colored bars stretch to the right is as much as removed. So the most is removed in these experiments by the Bubble King Mini and the Reef Octopus. They removed maybe 35% right here. And the least was the Eurereath CS80. And I put the prices down when I paid for them. Okay, you all, I'm sure, get them cheaper. I just bought them retail. And you can see that they're kind of different.
43 versus 774.
Well, you can see they're kind of different. But are they statistically different? Are they really different? And the answer is no. okay? You see these little things sticking out the front? Those aren't kind of cow catchers. They're error bars. So we did each run several times and averaged the results and got a standard deviation. And you can see some of these error bars are pretty big, some kind of small. But the consequence of having those error bars are that using a statistical technique to compare these, they're all indistinguishable. So there's no real difference in the performance that we could measure between any of these seven skimmers in terms of the amount of TOC they remove. They all remove between, say, 25% and 35%, and that's it. Okay? That's all we measured, and no matter how much we pay for it. Okay?
Doesn't it have to do with the makeup of total organic carbon?
Boy.
Some of it is amino acids.
I didn't pay him, but that's exactly what my next slide's going to address. I didn't pay him to ask that question, but thank you. Okay, so the question is, why in the world are we seeing this behavior? What's going on in a skimmer? Okay? Oh, I should mention, Bruce asked a question about airflow. I don't have the data in this talk, but we did look at the air stone skimmer, and we looked at airflow, and we did see some change, but not tremendous, actually. And then we looked at another skimmer, and we didn't see any change. I don't remember which one we looked at, actually, right on top of my head. It was, I just don't remember. But we didn't see much going on. So now let's try to understand why skimmers are only pulling out 25-35%. Okay, so what you see here is my cartoon drawing of a skimmer. The water comes in here, it exits here. We introduce air, the air bubbles through the water column and forms a foam here. Foam rises up the riser tube and fills up the collection cup, and then we remove it physically, and that's our nutrient export mechanism. Okay, let's take a closer peek at what's happening at the air bubbles as they rise up the water column. So in aquarium water, there's all kinds of total organic carbon, dissolved organic carbon. It's an exceedingly heterogeneous collection of chemicals. All of them have what we would call a hydrophilic chemical functionality. That means water loving. That's how they get soluble in water. If they didn't have a hydrophilic portion, they would not dissolve. You wouldn't see them. Okay? And some of them I illustrate as being completely hydrophilic by these solid blue circles right here. Okay? But there are other types of organic molecules that have not only this hydrophilic water-loving part, but have a hydrophobic water-hating part, which I'm showing by this red kind of patch. And molecules that have a hydrophobic patch really don't like to be in water. They're energetically not that stable because of the bad interaction between the hydrophobic patch and the water. And so when they encounter an air bubble, they have an opportunity to really stabilize themselves. They plant themselves on the surface of the bubble, and they project their hydrophobic water-hating part into the airspace of the bubble where there's no water. That makes them much more stable. In fact, they coat the surface of the bubble. Another word for these molecules you may have heard is surfactant. Okay? And so then they coat the surface of the bubbles when they form the foam, and we just physically pull the foam out and we remove those molecules. But these totally hydrophilic molecules, at least molecules that lack a significant hydrophobic region, they don't interact with bubbles. Okay? They just sit in the water. They don't do anything. And so they don't get removed by protein skimming. So the question then is, how many of these removable molecules are there versus these non-removable molecules? Well, so TOC is functionally composed of molecules, I'll call them labile, that are removed by skimming, and I'll call them refractory, not removed by skimming. What's the ratio? Well, our experimental data indicates the ratio is about 25-75. So most of the molecules that are organic molecules in your tank do not have enough hydrophobic patches to be picked up by bubbles. Bubbles are kind of a crappy way to extract organics, basically. And nothing that I'm saying has anything to do with skimmer performance tweaking or skimmer performance or skimmer engineering. This is a fundamental limitation of bubbles as an extraction medium. Okay? So what have we learned about skimmers so far? Okay, we know that skimmers
isn't it that, back to that last slide, is it my understanding at the time when I was selling skimmers that is this a negative positive charge thing, or is it the way you're describing it here? Is there a negative and a positive charge, like a bubble was a negative and the thing is a positive?
No. Bubbles are basically air. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's no charge to a bubble.
Okay.
Now, there are charges to organic molecules. Some are positive and some are negative, and those are the things that confer water solubility to the molecules. Okay. And there are other parts of molecules that have no charges, and they're what we call hydrophobic. All the lipids, for instance, that are in cell walls of things have hydrophobic patches. And those are the kinds of molecules that I'm attempting to illustrate in cartoon form.
Yeah, that's really great. Okay.
All right, so we know that skimmers only remove about 20 to 35% of the organics. And what we don't know, and this is obviously an important thing, is we really don't know what the threshold is for total organic carbon levels in aquaria where our livestock begins to become threatened. Okay, so what makes these guys unhappy? I don't know what the level is. 10 parts per million, no good for stony corals. 2 parts per million, okay for stony corals. I don't know in between. Obviously, some corals are going to be more susceptible than others. And there's another very important question that I don't know the answer to, and I'm going to leave it up to your judgment. And that's the reason why I've been showing you pictures of livestock, all the corals and fish you see in my tank. And here's some more of my livestock. Maybe my tank's idiosyncratic. All the data we've taken is from my tank. Okay, but is your tank like my tank? Well, can you export my conclusions to your tank? And so I've been showing you my livestock so you can make a judgment whether that's a fair process or not. Here's some more fish I have, some more corals. You get the idea. Okay. Well, maybe at this point in time I've built up a little bit of a contradiction. I'm sort of selling you on the idea that skimmers really don't remove much in the way of organics from the tank. But on the other hand, I showed you pictures of my skimmer cup and my 0.4 grams of skimmate out of my tank. What in the heck is all that stuff I'm pulling out? I'm probably not pulling out my stuff out. So maybe I'm setting you up. And to hopefully convince you that I'm not contradicting myself, what the next thing we wanted to do was ask the question, what the heck's in skimmate? What are we pulling out of our tanks? Okay, let's find out. So the experiment that we did was we took some skimmate in my skimmer, and we centrifuged it down. We give a liquid fraction, which is this kind of lighter brown stuff here, and a solid fraction, which is the dark blackish stuff. We simply poured off the liquid, which we also analyzed. It's basically just dilute seawater, dilute tank water. And we analyzed the solid by drying it down into this powder. And we analyzed it using a technique, which has a fancy name, inductively coupled plasma atomic emission spectroscopy. Don't worry about it. It's fancy, but it's a standard way to answer the question, what is the composition of elements in a solid sample? And you can do all the elements, basically, on this. We don't want to do all the elements. We did some relevant to Aquarius. And let me give you an example of the kind of data you can collect using this technique. Here are some elements that are important to us. Carbon, nitrogen, and hydrogen are signature elements of organic stuff. So this means organic mostly. Okay. Calcium, magnesium, and silicon are inorganic. And then there's some common ions that are in seawater. Okay. And just as an example, if you take natural seawater and dry it down, you get a salt, a powder, okay, all the water's gone. If you analyze natural seawater solid by this technique, you find this is weight percent, you find there's almost no carbon, almost no nitrogen. This is carbonate and some maybe ammonium or nitrate. There's a little teeny bit of organic. So there's almost no carbon and nitrogen. There's about 1% calcium, about 4% magnesium, almost no silicon, and seawater salt is almost all sodium and chloride. It's 86% sodium and chloride. You all need that, probably. A little bit of sulfur by way of sulfate, a little bit of potassium. Now, let's apply the same analytical technique to this solid skimmate. Let's find out what we're taking out. So, look at this. Now, here's a comforting thought to those of us who invested in skimmers, and I certainly am one of them. Look at how much we concentrate carbon, a signature element of organics, from almost nothing to 22.5%. That's not so bad. Nitrogen as well, you can't measure hydrogen by this technique, so that doesn't matter. So nitrogen, you see we're concentrating up to almost 3%. We're doing a good job of taking organics out after all, not all of them, but some. But here's the real surprise. This was expected, right? We're pulling organics out. I'm going to show you next, totally blew me away. Look at all the inorganics we're taking out. Calcium is 1% in seawater. We're pulling out 11%, 10 times as much calcium in our skimmate, in our solid. Magnesium, 2% silicon. Almost no silicon in water. We're pulling out 9% silicon in our skimmate. These are inorganic elements. Normally we wouldn't consider them contributing to anything under the heading of pollution.
Okay? I'm going to ask you where your silicon is coming from.
Boy, you are good. That's where we're going with this next. Okay? That's an important question. Where all these things are coming from. I'm getting there. All right, and then there's some common ions of seawater around. So all that means, well, we had some water kind of entrained in the solid. We didn't really worry about it too much.
Did you guys check iodine?
We did. I don't have it on the slide. It was nothing very special. It wasn't. Skimmers don't pull out a lot of iodine. I published an article on this in Advanced Aquarius in 2010 that lists iodine and phosphate and iron and all those things. I just didn't include it in this particular slide. So I don't remember off the top of my head. So the important thing is, these are just elements. What we really want to be able to do is assign them to molecules. What molecules are we pulling out? And to do that, we have to make some assumptions. We can call them guesses if you want. Hypotheses is a fancier word. I'd like to start at the bottom. So sodium, chlorine, potassium come through as their ions, nothing fancy. Sulfur isn't really sulfur. It's part of sulfate. That's our assignment of it. Okay, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Assigning a chemical structure to an element. The inorganics, calcium, these all have to be insoluble in water because they precipitate out when they're skimming. Calcium most surely is calcium carbonate. Magnesium is magnesium carbonate. Silicon, silicon dioxide. Now, there's no single organic molecule we can assign these to. It's just too complex. But there is a percentage of different elements in organics in general that come from living sources. And those numbers are 45% carbon, 7 nitrogen, 7 hydrogen. So we use this as sort of a canonical organic structure. And the reason why we go through all this hassle is to give you the next column of data, which is the real punchline of the slide. What is the weight percent of the actual chemical elements we're pulling out? We're pulling out about 8% of common seawater ions. As I said, we just entrained some water, nothing special. But the interesting thing are the pink and the green numbers. We're pulling out about, using this assumption, about 38% of skimmate is organic stuff. Don't know the structure, but it's general organic stuff. But look at this, 54%, more than half of that stuff we're so glad we're pulling out of our tank, are things like calcium carbonate, magnesium carbonate, silicon dioxide. We work hard to put calcium carbonate into our tanks using calcium reactors and calc washer, okay? But our skimmate's pulling out 10% by weight of calcium carbonate. Man, we're stripping our tank of calcium carbonate by skimming. How in the world could this be true? What the heck is going on here? Well, let's find out. Okay, so these are optical microscopy pictures taken by Jamie Kunkel of the Penn State Material Science Department for me of my skimming. These are really high resolution pictures of my skimming. What I want to draw your attention to, maybe too dark to see, you see there's a bunch of these triangles up here, these kind of Mercedes-Benz-y things, a bunch of them down here. Here's a picture of some bigger ones. This is this is 50 microns, this is 200 micron resolution, okay? These things are pieces of sponges. They're structural elements of sponges called spicules from the Leucoselenia species. My tank is full of these cryptic little sponges, as I told you earlier. And they're made out of, surprisingly, calcium carbonate. So my skimmer is scrubbing sponge spicules from my tank. Now, it doesn't mean scrubbing from your tank if you don't have these sponges, but it's scrubbing from my tank. You see this little, I don't know if you can tell, it's kind of a curlicue thing here, a little snail. Here's another one, maybe it's bigger. You can see this? Those are foraminifera. They're tiny planktonic organisms, little snails. Their shells are calcium carbonate. We also probably are pulling out coccolithophores, but it's hard to see them with resolution problems. And I'm definitely pulling out diatoms from my tank because my sand bed is brown in some places. The shells of diatoms are made of silicon dioxide. And we all have diatoms in our tank to some level. Okay? So my skimmer is pulling out all these tiny planktonic organisms with their shells of inorganic stuff. We're pulling out their guts too, so we're pulling out the organics of their guts. And it's skimming out random organic molecules, presumably. So we have some prima facie evidence that skimmers are pulling out stuff we really would like to keep in the tank. These little things are food, the things higher in the food chain. We don't really want to pull them out. Okay, so that's all I wanted to tell you about skimmers. What we learned was skimmers, at least the skimmers we tested, pull out not that much in the way of organics, 20 to 35%. And skimming itself, at least the skimming from my tank, is mostly inorganic stuff. It's not even mostly organic stuff. Kind of a downer with skimmers. Let's see if I can pump you up a little bit by talking about granular activated carbon, okay? One of the other exciting methods of water mediation. So we looked at two different kinds of GAC in our studies. This is hydrocarbon 2, this is ROX from bulk resupply. And this is Sanjay's 29-gallon polluted tank. And let's see the kind of experiments that we ran. So what you see here is we took a tank that never saw skimmer, GAC, or water change and stuck 200 grams of ROX GAC in a Fosban reactor and just ran the tank water through it. And this particular day, Sanjay's tank started about 7.5 parts per million of TOC. Look at that drop off, all the way down to about 1.5 parts per million of TOC after maybe about 12 hours or so. So we've removed 85% of our TOC with GAC. That's not so bad, okay? How good is a skimmer on this tank? Maybe we've kind of rigged the system a little bit with special TOC, okay? So we stuck a Urarese skimmer on this tank. The different day, the starting point was 6.5 parts per million. We had some problems collecting data here. Sanjay's not here, so I'll blame him. And we lost all of 9% of our TOC. So the skimmer didn't remove a whole lot of TOC from this water. GAC removed almost all of it. Okay, that's not so bad to know. The surface of GAC is a much better chemical medium for binding both hydrophilic and hydrophobic types of organic molecules, whereas we learned that bubbles just don't touch the hydrophilic ones. Okay, so once again, bubbles aren't such a good medium. Now, one thing we were curious about is there any difference between these two different kinds of GAC? I mean, they look different. They price out differently, but do they perform differently? So let's find out. What we did was now we're using my aquarium water, 150 grams of GAC in a Fosban reactor, and we're running the water through the Fosban reactor and measuring the percent TOC remaining as a function of time over an hour, hour and a half. And the first thing I want to show you is the ROX GAC is the pink line, the hydrocarbon 2 is the green line, and they both end up at about the same place. They both start at 100%, they both end up, I don't know, around 40% of TOC remaining. So they both removed roughly 60%. That's maybe a measure of their capacity. Okay, I'm not sure, but maybe. But do they do so at the same rate? The rate is how fast they drop down. You can see the answer is no. The pink line, the ROX GAC, drops down a lot faster than the hydrocarbon 2. Okay? They go to the same place, but the ROX GAC gets there faster. Now, we can actually quantify the difference between these lines. It involves some fancy math I'm not going to torture you with. But the bottom line is that the ROX GAC is about twice as fast as the hydrocarbon 2 at removing organics. So the take-home message here is, if you're in an emergency tank situation, you've over-medicated your tank, your sea cucumber hit your power head, and you really need to clean out your tank water quickly, probably your best bet is ROX GAC, better than hydrocarbon 2, and certainly better than skimming. It's a lot faster than skimming. Okay, there's a couple other, I call them odd GAC facts. There's nothing fancy here. We wondered, does flow rate through the Fosban reactor matter? Okay, and the answer is sort of, but not too much. So we did a bunch of experiments in which we varied flow rate in separate different experiments and measured the rate. Now we're using a blue dye in freshly prepared salt water because it's easier to do than TOC. It's a different system, I admit, but it's just, we use it as an analogy. And so here's the rate, or these numbers are analogous or to the rate of proportional to the rate of removal. And let's look at 150 grams of hydrocarbon 2. So we do an experiment with a 20 gallon per hour flow rate, and we get a rate that's right about here. And then we jack the flow rate up to 100 gallons an hour, and now we're up here, and the rate goes up to here. So the thing I want to show you is these five different independent experiments is look what happens right here. These three data points at 50 to 100 gallons per hour, they don't change very much. Okay? Then we did a different experiment where we used just 100 grams of hydrocarbon 2, and we did four different flow rates, four different independent experiments, 50 to 90 gallons per hour, and you see they just don't change much. The flow rate here just doesn't change. And so the take-home message is, if you're using a Fosban reactor, you want to be above 50 gallons an hour, but once you're above 50 gallons an hour, you don't really buy much in terms of rate of removal, okay? And the other thing we wondered about, and this is for all you do-it-yourselfers, if you're going to make your own GAC reactor, do you want short, fat, or tall, skinny? Show of hands. Who says short, fat's going to be better, faster than you? No one wants to do it. One short, fat, tall, skinny?
Tall, skinny.
Okay, so about eight tall, skinnies and one short, fat. Let's find out. So here's short, fat, and tall, skinny, 150 grams of GAC in each one. The tall, skinny is about 1.5 times faster. And it's not a random event. If you actually do the math, it makes sense. What you're really seeing is a manifestation of radial diffusion in a wider column. Okay. So the math, if you do the math without knowing anything about GAC, you would predict about 1.3 to 1. So tall skinny is better than short fat. So we learned four things about GAC. We learned GAC is much we learned it's faster than bubbles than skimming, and it takes out more organics than skimming. Okay. We learned that if you're using a 5-minute reactor, you want to be above 50 gallons an hour, but once you're above it, it doesn't matter. We learned that ROX GAC is faster than hydrocarbon 2, and we learned that tall skinny is better than short fat. Sean?
Do you imagine that it's surface area, so the smaller particles of the ROX are actually giving you more surface area to absorb this stuff?
It's not as simple as that, but I think it is surface area. See, the surface area, the surface area that matters for GAC is not the surface of the pellet, which is irrelevant. It's the fact that there's about a million times as much surface area in the interior, because GAC is really porous, and that's what you buy when you buy GAC, the porous interior. So does ROX have a more porous interior? I assume that's what we're seeing the reflection of, but I don't know. Now, people can measure porosity, and they do. As far as I've been able to determine, no one has measured it for ROX, so they've measured for other kinds of GAC. And there is a spread. GAC is used in wastewater treatment, so I mean, people do this for real, for a living. But I've never seen ROX measure, so I can't give you a number. Okay. All right. So one more little topic I want to talk about, and then I'm done. We've learned about two legs of the three legs of the water remediation school. We talked about skimmers, and maybe not doing what you thought. We talked about GAC, maybe doing more than you thought. What about bacteria? So the problem is POC in the tank, skimmers, GAC, remove it. What the heck is bacteria doing? Well, I showed you two data sets earlier that seem to indicate bacteria, at least implicated bacteria, circumstantially is playing a role. This is the Fourier-Pages experiment where the TOC goes up, and then with no water remediation methodology, it comes right back down, consumption by microbes and ultimately filter feeders. And then my own tank data, feed the tank, TOC goes up, comes back down, no skimmer, no GAC, presumably bacteria are eating, and then things eat the bacteria, et cetera, et cetera. So that brings me to my last topic, the carbon dosing hypothesis. So this is a relatively recent introduction to reef husbandry. It's a nutrient reduction technique which has some assumptions in it. It assumes that bacteria growth in your tank is carbon limited. So if you add a carbon source, like ethanol or vodka people use, probably there's some special kinds of vodka, I don't really know, it will fuel bacteria growth, and as the bacteria grow, they'll suck up nitrogen and phosphorus nutrients, stripping them out of your water, which is what you want, and then if you can remove the bacteria from the water somehow, or from your tank, I should say, maybe by skimming, people speculate, then you'll be removing nutrients. That's the carbon dosing hypothesis. Does it work? Is it true? That's what I'm going to talk about. So here's the problem. We have our corals, we have our fish, they dump in TOC into our tank, bacteria eat the TOC, and if we had a way to count bacteria so we could determine how the level of bacteria, at least in the water column, that's all we can do, bacteria in the water column change as a function of some perturbation like feeding or skimming or whatever, we can then maybe address some of these questions. And so we do, and it's called flow cytometry. This is my student Allison Place, who's running a Coulter flow cytometer right now. And the kind of data we get out of the flow cytometer is a bacteria concentration. For instance, a number like 100,000 bacteria per mil would come out of this instrument. And in this case, bacteria, according to this instrument, what it looks at is defined as any object that we size select for between a half a micron and 6 microns in diameter and contains double-stranded DNA. So we eliminate all kinds of detritus and crap like that, or we eliminate bigger organisms like copepods and zooplankton that are much bigger than bacteria. This is the bacteria size range, obviously. We could also eliminate phytoplankton to a large extent. We have some other tricks I'm not going to go into. So we're just counting bacteria. Phytoplankton don't really eat carbon. They photosynthesize, taking inorganic CO2. So we're just looking at bacteria that eat carbon. So let's see what we found out. Here's a table of data. This is basically to show you what baseline is. So here's some data that did not come from us, from the literature, however. These are natural reefs, Hawaii, South Pacific, and Florida Keys. And the bacteria count in the water of these reefs is, say, between a half a million and a million and a half bacteria per mil. So healthy reefs have a lot of bacteria, maybe. That's what the number is. Here's some numbers from our own data. Allie went on vacation to the Florida Keys, you know, one of these spring break things. And I asked her to bring back some water. So she brought back some water from a mangrove estuary shoreline. Water polluted, And bacteria count expresses that 3.5, 4.5 million, much more than the pristine reef. Okay. Then some negative controls, the RODI makeup water for my tank, about 1,000 bacteria per mil. It's basically sterile. Aquafina bottled water, about 1,500 bacteria per mil. State College tap water, about 27,000 bacteria per mil. Now let's look at the reefs. So here are three tanks, Here are three tanks under Sanjay's care, under his relaxed husbandry regime. No skimmer, no GAC, no granular ferric oxide, no water change. And the TOC levels in the day we measured were pretty high, 2 to 3 parts per million. Okay? Look at the bacteria counts, 500,000 to 1,000,000 bacteria per mil. So on these unfiltered tanks, Sanjay is spot on to where natural healthy reefs are. Okay? Now here's the big surprise, and again, I did not anticipate. Look at the tanks we worked so hard to purify. Sanjay's 500, my 175, Penn State 600. We all skim, we use GAC, GFO, we change our water. And that's reflected in the fact that the parts per million of carbon are pretty low, less than a part per million. But look at the bacteria counts, 70 to 140,000. One-tenth those of the unpurified tank, one-tenth of healthy reefs. What does it mean that our reef tanks, which we work so hard to mimic the parameters on healthy reefs to give our livestock the best chance of living, have a bacteria count that's one-tenth of healthy reef tanks? I don't know the answer to that. Okay. It obviously has no short-term effect because we can keep the tanks. Does it have a long-term effect? Does it contribute to old tank syndrome due to loss of diversity? We'll come back to that point later. But it's something, just an observation right now. I wish I had a theory or an explanation that makes some sense. Okay, so now let's test the carbon dosing hypothesis. So what I'm showing you here is what happens when we take 30 gallons of my reef tank water and remove it from my reef, remove it from all the bacteria consumers, the filter feeders, put it in a Rubbermaid tub, and dose it with one part per million of carbon per day using ethanol. So we start out at day equals zero, we're measuring bacteria per mil in the pink line, we're measuring total organic carbon in the turquoise line, and here's the one per PM of ethanol dosing every day for 5 days. And we start off real low, you know, 100,000 or so, and nothing happens, and then it zooms up. After a day, we're at 1.5 million. After 2 days, we're at 4 million bacteria per mil. So we take this as evidence that adding a carbon source to reef tank water does in fact fuel bacteria growth. We're growing bacteria like crazy. But then notice, after day two, it kind of starts dying off, and then day four or five, the bacteria count drops off. What's going on? I speculate that the bacteria is growing and sucking up nitrogen and phosphorus in this finite volume of tank water. Eventually, it runs out of some other nutrient that it needs. And when it runs out of that nutrient, they stop growing, they start dying, and that's what we see happening. Okay. Let's see if the total organic carbon line corroborates that hypothesis. The total organic carbon, we start off right here at about 0.5 parts per million. Then we add 1 part per million of ethanol, and the count jumps up to 1.5 parts per million right here. That's just an internal check of our measurement technique. Okay. We add 1 part per million, we show that. But you notice, it doesn't keep going up. It levels off, and then we add more ethanol, starts going down. We add more ethanol, creeps up a little, and then right around here, the carbon levels start increasing more significantly. When the bacteria start dying instead of growing, they're no longer sucking up carbon anymore. Here they're eating carbon, metabolizing, giving off carbon dioxide. They chew it up and give off carbon dioxide. Here, the carbon level's going up in my tank because now the bacteria aren't growing. They're not eating carbon so much anymore. So it all kind of hangs together. Nitrate reduction. At the beginning, I'm using the Salford kit, which we all know is kind of iffy because of the eyeballing. Nitrate, 2.5 to 5 parts per million, drops down to maybe 1 to 2 parts per million. So I do see a decrease in nitrate over, what, 5 days, just like you might expect. Nitrate's being consumed. Okay. Now, here's a bit of a curveball, what I'm going to show you next. This chunk of water came out of my reef tank. There's no bacteria predators anymore, right? What happens in an authentic reef tank where there's a full ecosystem with things that eat bacteria? So here's my reef tank. I went to carbon dosing for a month, 30 days, and we're looking in the pink line of bacteria per mil and the green line, turquoise line, of nitrate. And my ethanol dosing schedule followed one suggested by Walton in the reef keeping article. So every day I dosed ethanol starting at 0.17 parts per million, cranking up to about 0.84 parts per million at the end of the month. So every day I dosed. These are just the increased points. And the interesting thing is, look at the bacteria per mil count. Yeah, there's a couple of spikes, but it pretty much shoots straight across. I'm not changing the bacteria level in my tank upon carbon dosing, okay? Because I know from my previous experiment, I'm definitely fueling bacteria growth, but the things that eat bacteria are growing too, because their food source, the bacteria, are growing. So the natural biological filtration is keeping things kind of level, okay? That's not such a bad thing to happen, actually. What happens to my nitrate? We care about nitrate because this is the reason why we're doing this, right? We want to lower the nitrogen and phosphorus. I can't measure phosphorus in my tank. It's always below my measurement technique. We start out about 3.5 parts per million. After a month, I'm down to about 2.5 parts per million. So my nitrate was never really high, but I've lowered my nitrate by carbon dosing. Okay? And that's not a surprise. Other people have reported that. But the interesting thing is I'm not really jacking up my bacteria. It's being taken care of internally. What about protein skimming? Does protein skimming remove bacteria? So here's 30 gallons of my reef tank water removed from my tank, put in a Rubbermaid tub, starting point 135,000 bacteria per mil, turn on the Bubble King, and it drops down. So we can drop down the level of bacteria by protein skimming. This is a control line, just to show that bacteria aren't growing over this time frame, 120 minutes. And it's about a 35% decrease, but it does level out. You see, right about here, 50 minutes, it just levels out, kind of, at around 90,000-95,000. What did we learn? It appears that there are different kinds of bacteria. Some bacteria are susceptible to bubble removal. Some bacteria aren't going to be touched by bubbles because of their surface characteristics, and they're not removed by skimming. So think about what we're doing when we skim our tanks. We're applying selective pressure to remove some bacteria from the tank, but not others. So we're artificially changing the evolution of the tank's bacteria by skimming. Is that good? Is that bad? Are we losing diversity? What's the long-term consequence? I'm not sure. It's something to think about.
So did you determine whether the loss of bacteria was they were being removed by the skimmer or their food source was being removed by the skimmer and they were dying off?
They were, over the course, we did control experiments, they're not dying off over 2 hours. This is just 2 hours. If we let them go for a longer time, yes. But we did controls and their levels are pretty much the same here. I mean, obviously they fluctuate. This is one of our worst control experiments, but they don't change that much.
So it is removed?
Yeah. Now, that's at over 2 hours. Now, if you let it go longer, as I said, we do see die. This is in a chunk of water yanked out of my tank. What about a real reef aquarium? This is a little artificial. Let's skim a real reef aquarium and see what happens to bacteria. This is Sanjay's 55. When we're doing this experiment, he no longer had GAC on it, and he has been dosing vodka to the tune of 3 parts per million a day for about 6 months before we did the skimmer run. Consequently, with no remediations, bacteria levels quite high, starting at about 2.3 million bacteria per mil compared to my 135,000. So we put on the BK skimmer and skim away and look at the bacteria numbers. They drop right down, and after maybe 6 or 8 hours, we're down to about 1.5 million bacteria per mil. And it levels off here. About a 37% decrease, very similar, essentially the same as my 35% decrease. Once again, suggesting in my tank, water and his authentic tank, there are some kinds of bacteria that can be skimmed and some kinds of bacteria that are not susceptible to bubble-based removal. Now, there are many, many other ways to remove bacteria. They get eaten by other organisms. That means their nutrient content gets converted to biomass. This is good. We want our corals to eat bacteria and grow. So that's fine. All I was wanting to test in this particular experiment was the role of skimmers. Did skimmers make a difference or not? All right. So basically, I'm done. I just want to wrap up with a few conclusions. Okay, so what did we learn about tank water remediation that keeps my fish looking healthy and my corals looking healthy and happy? Well, we learned that reef tanks resemble natural reefs in their appearance, but in terms of their function, they more resemble sewage treatment plants. Because like sewage treatment plants, we employ foam fractionation, granular activated carbon, and bacteria to help remediate and remove organics from the water. Now we learned that if you apply all these techniques, then your tank water should have total organic carbon levels in the natural reef range, but the bacteria counts are about 1/10 the natural reef range. Okay? It's a bit of a surprise. We learned that with a greater variation in the prices of the different skimmers that we looked at than there was in the capacity of those skimmers to remove TOC. And that raises maybe a philosophical point. Is it really worth obsessing about skimmer parameters and skimmer fine-tuning, or even spending a pile of money on a skimmer, if it leaves behind 60 to 80% of the organics in any event? We learned that GAC is much better than bubbles and skimming at removing TOC. But of course, bubbles are cheap, and GAC costs money. And so there's a cost effectiveness trade-off that you're going to have to, you know, factor into that kind of decision. And finally, we learned that carbon dosing did not increase the steady state bacterial concentrations per se in the reef tank, although they do fuel bacteria growth. And we learned that skimming removes some, maybe a third or a little bit more, of the bacteria present. But it doesn't necessarily remove more than that. And we learned, of course, that, as many people have demonstrated before me, that nitrate levels are reduced. So again, I want to thank you all for coming out on a rainy night. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to field them.
You were mentioning how long you were leaving carbon in. How often are you changing carbon? What's a good recycle time?
Let me make a couple. The question was, how often should you change your carbon?
You know it's full.
Pardon me?
How do you know it's full? You said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me. I can't give you a short answer. What I can tell you is the following. Okay. We published a paper in Advanced Aquarius magazine. I think it was 2008 or 9. In which we developed a mathematical model to answer that question. The input of the model is how many gallons you have, how many grams of GAC do you use, and is your tank a tank that you skim or not? So if you input those parameters into a math equation, or just look at the curve and draw a line across, you'll get an answer. It depends how much GAC you use and how you water buy. That entire analysis was based upon using not real total organic carbon, but a dye as a model. Now, we just currently, my student Ali is working on determining what the capacity of GAC is to bind total organic carbon. After 2 years of trying and failing, we finally figured out how to solve that problem, I think, and we're working on it right now. But if you believe that dyes, that organic dyes are a decent model for organic carbon, just look at that and just plug it in. It depends how much GAC you use. So for instance, in my tank, I have about 168 gallons. I use 150 grams of GAC. So, you know, roughly whatever that mass out to be. In 2 weeks, my GAC is 90% saturated. So I went for the 90% saturation point. Okay.
But how do you know it's saturated?
If you measure the kinetics, if you measure the rate at which GAC accumulates organic, which you can measure physically, which we did, and you know how much the GAC can hold in total when it's saturated, you know how long it takes to reach that saturation point. That's the way we did the experiment. But it's, like I said, it lets some complicated math, and I would urge you just to read that, but read that with a little caution, because when we come up with a new number of saturation using real TOC as opposed to a blue dye, those numbers may change. And I hope to do that by the summer.
And different carbons, you know, because I know
we only looked at hydrocarbon 2, black diamond, and ROX. And the numbers I'm citing, I think, were just for hydrocarbon 2. So beyond that, I think it's those.
I should say
skimmers are really, really important for promoting gas exchange. It's really important to take CO2 out and then oxygen into your tank, and the bubbles of skimmers really have a valuable function there. So that's important for skimmers. I should have mentioned that when I was trashing it.
What about refugiums or plant?
I'm sorry, what about them?
They're
a great idea.
Are they in a play in any of these experiments?
I didn't have a refugium. I wish I did, I don't have a room. But refugiums suck up nitrogen and phosphorus nutrients as the algae in them grows. So they are really useful, and I sure wish I had room for one. That's all I can tell you. So my whole tank's a refugium in a way.
Skimmer right there.
Low bacteria rates in our tanks are causing problems in any way? Did you guys?
I don't know. You know, I looked at many tanks that were skimmed, many being about 6, and the bacteria levels were all low. I mean, maybe I just showed you 1 or 2, I don't remember. So it's not like it's a freak occurrence. The question is, what does that mean? Now, all these tanks have been around for years, and they've all gone through what we would call life and death cycles. You know, tanks need to have a rhythm, like after a couple of years things start going bad. Sometimes it's called old tank syndrome. Is that due to the fact that we're skimming bacteria and changing the population, changing the diversity, removing necessary bacteria gradually over time, removing bacteria that are susceptible to skimming, especially if you're taking it from tree, you don't add too many corals. The way around that is, and here's something you tell your spouse, you need to add new corals every once in a while with their new bacteria load, even their crappy brown ones, right? So if you add, especially ones that have been, that have so-called wild ones, are not in somebody's tank for a really long time. Every once in a while you add bacteria, okay, you can help promote that. Now I know there are lots of bacterial elixirs people sell. I don't remember the names actually. Do they matter? I'll tell you something I didn't put a slide on. I make up my makeup water in a Rubbermaid garbage can. Every week I make up a new batch. If I take pure RODA water in my salt mix, mix it up, T equals zero, my bacteria count is like nothing, 10,000 bacteria per minute. In a day or two, I'm up to a million. So when I do, and then in 2 days after that, I'm down to about 300,000 or 500,000. If I do a water change after a day, I'm adding around one in my tank. Let's say 500,000 to 1,000,000 bacteria per mil that are stable salt water bacteria. So my garbage can is coated with organic fry. Bacteria grow like crazy. So I don't need to go out and buy some bacteria mix. All I do is a water change after a couple of days, and I'm taking my tank, which is 100,000 bacteria per mil, and I'm dumping in 1,000,000 bacteria per mil. So I'm dosing my tank with bacteria every time I do water changes. I don't know what bacteria I'm dosing.
Have you seen any difference, like if you were to just use carbon to bring the organic carbons down, does that affect the bacterial loads?
I can't say. I can tell you that GAC itself does not remove bacteria from tank water. We did that experiment, flat lines across. But I can't tell you, I just can't say. So GAC, as Bruce pointed out, is a medium that will grow lots of bacteria. So when you do that, you're growing bacteria, then you physically throw the GAC in your trash, you're throwing out a lot of bacteria, and that's not a bad thing to do. Now whether that's more or less than skimming, I don't know the numbers.
It probably would be better because you're not throwing away just certain bacteria.
Right.
Well,
I don't
versus
know.
Skimming.
But I just don't know the answer to that question.
So what you're saying is using sterilizers designed to kill bacteria, break down the DNA, but
we've done that experiment. Sterilizer on, sterilizer off. No change in the tank profile.
Okay.
Doesn't affect anything.
Because you don't have a strong enough
yeah.
UV sterilizer.
I mean, if you wanted to, what sterilizers will do is they'll kill some organisms, but you know the ones that we buy in the hobby just don't have the
powerful enough. They'll do enough to maybe damage them,
yes.
But not kill.
You
them.
Have to really have a powerful UV. I don't even think you. I was just going to say, I don't even think you can buy one that in the hobby. I know I have one in my chemical laboratory that will do that. But if you look at that, you go blind. You get for 5 seconds, you're blind.
Yeah.
Okay. So you don't want to get near that kind of UV.
30-watt or 26-watt
yeah.
UV.
I mean, I think it's a 1,000-watt or 800-watt UV that I use for some chemistry experiments.
Yeah,
that'll kill anything, but it'll also kill your eyes. So you couldn't sell that to hobbyists. That's a liability.
But go on to eBay if you get a used one.
Yeah. I would not advise getting a real powerful UV, for real. I mean, it really could damage
you. You're not going to have any more kids, are you, Brad?
Not after that, I won't.
Any other questions?
Great job.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ken.
You're very welcome. Nice meeting some of you. If you have any questions, come on up.